to the Student Press Law Center podcast for August 2008, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a champion for student voices. We recognize the essential role that free speech and a free press play in a democratic society. The SPLC is committed to nurturing and protecting those freedoms for the next generation. For more information about the center's work, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lomonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. The Student Press Law Center defends the rights of student journalists to publish their ideas and opinions. That used to mean publishing in student newspapers, and sometimes there were student radio or television stations, but news is moving online in a big way, and so are the legal censorship battles that define young people's First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court said almost 40 years ago that students are citizens with constitutional rights, and they don't lose all their First Amendment rights when they walk through the schoolhouse gate, even though schools can sometimes limit the method of expression to prevent disruption. We all assume the Supreme Court meant that when students walk back out of that gate at the end of the school day, they turn back into full-fledged citizens and regain their free speech rights. Some school officials are challenging that assumption and trying to expand their disciplinary authority to reach school speech that takes place off school grounds on personal time if the speech is about the school and might cause controversy at the school. At least one influential federal court has recently bought into that argument in a case called Doniger versus Niehoff. In the Doniger case, a Connecticut high school junior, Avery Doniger, got into a dispute with her principal over the scheduling of a Battle of the Bands concert that Avery, as secretary of her junior class, was helping organize. Avery testified that the principal told her the concert was being canceled. Avery got angry, went home, and on her family's computer posted a note on her personal blog on livejournal.com that called the administrators of the school, quote-unquote, douchebags, and urged people who opposed canceling the concert to call or write the superintendent's office to, quote-unquote, piss her off more. The school punished Avery for what she wrote by removing her as secretary of her class and preventing her from taking office as secretary of the senior class, even though she'd gotten the most votes. Avery went to court and asked for an immediate order restoring her as secretary of the senior class so she could hold that office until she graduated. But a district court refused to issue the order, and Avery appealed to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the court that handles appeals from New York, Connecticut, and Vermont. The Second Circuit came back with an opinion in May that sided with the school and found no First Amendment violation. The court's analysis mentioned the bad language that Avery used, but that wasn't the deciding factor in the case. The court decided that Avery's speech was punishable as being substantially disruptive to the school, which is the legal standard for punishing speech that takes place on school grounds during school time. Because she escalated her dispute with the principal to involve the public and caused the administrators to have to respond to phone calls and emails from the public. The court also focused on the fact that, in their view, the punishment given Avery was very slight. She wasn't expelled, and she didn't miss any school. The Doniger decision is inconsistent with a whole host of First Amendment legal precedent. First of all, the Supreme Court has said you can't punish a student for expressing her opinion even when she's on school property, unless the speech is somehow illegal, which this clearly was not, or the speech substantially disrupts the school, which means that the disruption really has to interfere with the ability to keep order at the school, like causing a walkout or urging students to commit violence, which this clearly was not. The fact that the principal has to respond to some calls and emails, and there's no indication there were all that many, is very far short of what other courts have recognized as a disruption. The other flaw in the Doniger decision is that the severity of the punishment really doesn't matter for purposes of the First Amendment. As long as the punishment is serious enough that it would discourage the speaker or discourage future speakers from saying things they have a legal right to say, that's enough to violate the First Amendment. Well, clearly, holding a class office is a valuable line on a young person's resume, and Having to explain to a college why you were kicked out of office for substantially disrupting the school is certainly a scary enough prospect that it would cause future students to censor themselves, and that means the punishment's more than enough to be unconstitutional. And of course, let's not forget, this wasn't speech on school grounds. There was no evidence that anybody at Avery Dunninger's high school read the blog or responded to the blog using a school computer during the school day. When we let schools punish what students say about the school when they're not using school computers on school time, it's hard to see a stopping point. What if the next Avery Dunninger isn't a student complaining about a concert? What if the next Avery Dunninger is complaining that the school bus drivers are drinking on the job or that the coach is molesting one of his students? The Second Circuit would say students have no right to complain to the local newspaper or go to the local TV station about anything if there's a chance that it might cause controversy at the school. But sometimes there needs to be controversy at the school, and sometimes the best journalism causes the most controversy. The concern of the Student Press Law Center isn't about the right to call your principal a bad name. It's about the right to go public if your principal is a bad person. Luckily, there's another case involving online student speech pending before another federal appeals court in Philadelphia, and there the chances for a decision favoring student First Amendment rights look much more hopeful. In that case, Layshock versus Hermitage School District, a student posted an outlandish parody of his high school principal on the social networking site MySpace. The profile was clearly a joke, admittedly, maybe not all that funny of a joke, but no reasonable person could look at it for 5 seconds and think the principal seriously had posted this profile about himself. Justin Layshock's principal wasn't amused, and he filed a defamation suit accusing Layshock of libeling him. He also suspended Justin from school. Justin sued to challenge the suspension, and a federal district court in Pittsburgh agreed with him that the school violated the First Amendment. The court correctly pointed out that the only quote-unquote disruption caused by this MySpace page was that a couple of students used a school computer to look at it during school. There's no evidence that there was any effect on the school's ability to teach or keep order, and in fact, the profile was such a non-event that it was online for over a week before any teachers or administrators even heard about it. Schools can certainly have blanket policies that say no looking at personal websites on school computers during class time, and they can certainly punish the people who violate those rules in a way that interferes with class. But we don't punish the authors of comic books or fashion magazines just because kids may find those magazines interesting and read them during class when they're supposed to be working. And we shouldn't let schools use the disciplinary powers of state government to punish students who post off-campus websites either just because someone happens to look at it during school. Justin's principal had it right when he went to court and brought his libel suit. Off-campus speech is a private matter between private citizens, and Justin's principal can't use his state authority to settle a private dispute over the MySpace page any more than he could use his state authority to punish Justin Layshock for backing into his car and denting his bumper on a Saturday at the shopping mall. We have a legal system that deals with private disputes, and that's where this one belongs. Justin's case is pending now before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Student Press Law Center is among the groups that have filed briefs supporting the rights of students to speak without fear of school discipline when they're outside of school. We're hopeful that when school administrators try to expand their disciplinary reach into students' private lives, the Third Circuit will slam the schoolhouse gate. Every month, the Student Press Law Center gets about 250 calls for assistance to its attorney hotline, and we try to use this podcast to highlight some of the most interesting and instructive calls. Recently, we were asked about the right to tape record a conversation during an interview. Liz White, SPLC's Publications Fellow, describes the situation.
Our college paper sent several reporters into a meeting with the college president. One of the reporters put a cassette tape recorder on the table in plain sight of the president and started recording. At the end of the conversation, the president picked up the recorder and said, "I didn't know this was recording," and confiscated the tape. Did we have the right to record the conversation?
The answer may depend on the state where the interview took place. The federal government, all 50 states, and the District of Columbia have laws against wiretapping of conversations. Wiretapping usually refers to telephone calls, but many laws extend the ban against wiretapping to include any recorded conversation, even in person. In 38 states and Washington, D.C., it's legal to record your own conversation, even if you don't tell the other person she's being recorded. But 12 states require that all participants in the conversation give consent. California, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, Nevada, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Washington are all so-called two-party consent states. But consent can mean sitting by and watching as somebody conspicuously tapes the conversation. It doesn't require that the person being recorded actually say the words, "Go ahead and record me." Several courts have expressly ruled that holding a tape recorder in plain sight in front of the person you're talking to is sufficient notice. By continuing to talk to you without objecting, the person has consented to being recorded. It's also much harder for someone to win an illegal taping claim where the conversation is in a setting like a newspaper interview where there's no expectation of privacy and the assumption is that everything being said is fair game to be published. Of course, the very safest practice is always to give warning. If you're concerned that the person may not give consent, it's enough simply to turn on the recorder, place it visibly on the desk, and say, "I'm switching this on." What all of these wiretapping laws have in common is that, unless you're a police officer with a warrant, it's always illegal to record a conversation that you don't participate in, like eavesdropping or placing a hidden microphone in a room. Fortunately, there were no James Bond spy games going on at this college, so it appears that their taping was legal. The SPLC website provides a link to a very comprehensive guide by the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press called Can We Tape? It includes citations to all 50 states' wiretapping and recording laws, and it's also accessible directly through the Reporters Committee website, www.rcfp.org. Well, that's the Student Press Law Center podcast for August 2008. Check out our website at www.splc.org, and if you're a student journalist or advisor with a question about your legal rights, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thanks for listening.